This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. Yes, this is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. talking about books that have been written, published, printed, and sold, and some that haven't as well. This afternoon in particular, I'm going to be talking in the first half of the program with Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni, well-known Indian-American novelist, perhaps best known for The Mistress of Spices, Sister of My Heart, The Vine of Desire, and other novels. We'll be talking about her new novel, The Palace of Illusions. And then in the second half of the program, I'll be talking with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. He's already been on this program three times over the past 3 years, 2 years rather, talking about his new book he's writing on the Great Books program. He started it about 2 years ago. He says he's nearly finished and it should be published in November. And in a short time, in the second half of the program, we'll be talking with him about exactly what's happening. But first, Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni, welcome to Booktown.
Thank you so much.
All of your novels are infused with Indian mythology, but they're basically stories of modern Indians, either in India or America, facing a lot of it is cultural change, but also traditional relationship problems. But Indian mythology always creeps in one way or another into so many of your stories. In your latest novel, it's devoted entirely to the great, or one of the two great Indian myths, the Mahabharata. Why did you decide to go back to that?
Well, the Mahabharata is a story that I grew up with, or I should say, you know, it's a compendium of thousands of stories that I grew up with, and it has always had held a great fascination for me. So I thought it was time. As you so rightly said, I've always been enamored of myth. I think the ancient stories have a great deal of power. They have a great deal to teach us. They have a great deal that is still completely timely and relevant to our lives today. And the Mahabharata certainly seemed to do all of this. And so I just wanted to devote an entire project to telling the story, but telling it a little differently.
Indian mythology, to my mind, is infinitely richer than Western mythology, and that's partly because its tradition is unbroken. In the West, we have Greek and Roman mythology, Egyptian, Norse, Celtic, and so on, but they are suddenly broken off and replaced by Christianity or Islam, which have their own mythologies, but they don't fit together, whereas Indian mythology has unraveled and developed for at least 3,000-4,000 years. One of the main characters in the Mahabharata and in your version of it is the person, the individual Krishna, who may be a god, may be a human or whatever, but his mythology as a god developed much of it hundreds and thousands of years after the Mahabharata was written. We don't have that advantage.
Right. It is a very rich culture, and I feel, you know, very blessed to be able to delve into it to write The Palace of Illusions. And you're so right, because the Mahabharata and the Ramayana are epics, and the story of Krishna and the story of other characters who appear in the Palace of Illusion, such as Panchali, the main character, they continue to have a strong hold on the Indian imagination. I think even now, I mean, people discuss them, people get into arguments over them, people have various interpretations of their characters, people revere them, or they question them. You know, it's just a very living part of Indian thought even today.
You mentioned Panchali, also known as Draupadi, who is the wife of the five Pandava brothers, part of two sets of cousins whose epic battle at the end, or toward the end of the epic, brings to the end the Dvapara Yuga, the third age, and we are now in the Kali Yuga, an entirely different age of humanity. Why did you decide to tell the story through her point of view?
Well, as you probably know, I've been interested in the woman's story for a long time. I have often felt that the woman's story has not received as much attention as it should have. And especially when you go back to the old tales, the men are in the center, and the women, although they are very interesting and complicated and strong characters, are kind of at the sidelines. Their stories only are told to us when they're connected or intertwined with what happens to the men. But I've been fascinated with the character of Panchali and the other women who appear in the Palace of Illusions ever since I was a little girl. And I always thought that if I were to retell a story, and at that time I never even really thought I would be retelling the story, because it's, you know, it's kind of a daunting project. But I thought that I would like to focus on the women, particularly Draupadi, who is in a very unique position because she's the only character in our mythology, in our literature, who's married to five men at the same time.
And so
right from the beginning, I think it was her story that I wanted to tell. How did she feel? How did she think about things? How did she respond to events? What went on in her head?
It begins with her birth, along with her brother Dri, a shortening of his full Sanskrit name, who were both born through fire, and they came into the world in a very unusual way. Almost everybody else in the epic is in somehow connected with gods or divine forces. There's really almost no separation between the divine and the human in that age.
That's right, and that's one of the things that was fascinating as well as challenging when I was writing, because I wanted to go back to the ancient story. I never wanted to retell it in modern time, as sometimes, you know, many writers have done, both in the East and the West. They've taken an ancient story, but they've put it into contemporary times.
Yeah, I've heard that the novel called The Great Indian Novel, which I've looked at but not read, is a modern retelling of the Mahabharata.
Right, but it has it's linked to, like, politicians and, you know, in our modern times and so forth. But I wanted to just go back because I love that ancient world so much. It has a great hold on my imagination. So I wanted to recreate that ancient world, that time in itself. And, you know, that was a big challenge.
In the versions of the Mahabharata that I've read, there are conflicts within some of the characters. You know that they are inclined to do one thing and then might wind up doing something else. I'm going to say among the male characters, the female characters are presented for the most part fairly one-dimensionally. In this case, though, you make Panchali three or possibly four-dimensional.
Well, thank you. That was exactly what I wanted, because just like you say, you know, the men have all these complexities and the women are presented one-dimensionally, and I wanted to, you know, I know that that wasn't the case. If you're thinking of them as real people living in a real time, that was not the case. So I wanted to imaginatively rediscover what these other dimensions might be.
How close did you stick to the exact plot? I talked to you about an hour ago, and there was one element in the plot that I didn't remember from a basically scanning a version of the Mahabharata. Are there, and but then you assured me that that episode actually was there and I had just missed it. Did you invent anything, or is...
Well, the major episodes are all based on the Mahabharata. I followed three different Mahabharatas. One was a translation by Raja Gopalachari. One was a translation by Kamala Subramaniam, because I wanted a woman's viewpoint. And one was a Bengali translation. Now, my mother tongue is Bengali. And so it's a Bengali verse translation that I pretty much had grown up with by Kashi Ram Das. And so all of the major incidents in the novel, in Palace of Illusions, come from one of these texts. Now, not all the texts agree with each other. There are different versions, which sometimes are quite different from each other. So I often compiled and I took things from different versions to put together my story. But most of the things are there. Where I have invented, because, and I felt, you know, inventing was very important. I was not just translating. I was recreating and I was imagining something. Is where Panchali's inner life is concerned, when she is doing something. For example, Karna, who is the great tragic hero of the Mahabharata, and who comes to her Swayamvar, her marriage, where, you know, she is going to be married, as you know, to the person who wins this very difficult competition. And she says to him, she shames him, she humiliates him in front of everyone by asking him, who is your father? And Karna doesn't know that. He can't answer. And she says, then you cannot participate. And this is actually going to cause a great deal of ill feeling between Karna and the Pandavas later on. And perhaps even be one of the major causes for the war. That is there in the original version. But what I added is, what was she feeling? Why did she do it? Now, because the Mahabharata in many ways is, simplifies the women characters, it just gives us a reason that this is what, you know, Krishna had advised her to do, and that's why she'd done it. But I give a whole other reason why she's done it. So I think that's where, for me, a great deal of interest in the novel lies, is why does Panchali do certain things? And by looking at why she does certain things, are we getting a different kind of sense of her character?
I'm almost tempted to reveal the outcome, not of who Karna's father actually is. Speaking to Westerners, I would feel a little bit like I'm cheating. But
right,
if I were speaking
we shouldn't give it away.
But
we
to
should say it's a great surprise.
But Indians all know this from childhood, and yet they read the story again and again, hear it again and again, and see movies and TV shows again and again.
Right.
What's the difference? Are we missing something by depending on suspense?
No, I think, you know, literature has many kinds of pleasures for its readers, and one is the pleasure of discovery, and one is the pleasure of recognition. So when you know the end of the story already, and you're reading it, and this is how it was with the Greek myth, you know, when people went to see Oedipus, Sophocles' Oedipus, they already knew what was going to happen, but they were interested in seeing how is Sophocles going to make his Oedipus different from the previous Oedipuses that they had known. And that's kind of what I want my readers who are familiar with the Mahabharata to come away with. Well, how is this Panchali different? How is her, the interpretation or her motive or her ultimate understanding of life different from what they'd come across in the Mahabharata? But for everyone who doesn't know the Mahabharata, then, you know, as you might guess, there are many Indians also who don't know the Mahabharata for many reasons. You know, maybe they just haven't had that traditional upbringing. And for them, too, the story is a surprise. So, you know, it's just a very good story. And I can say that without, you know, I can say that because I didn't create that story. It's just a very good story, and I was able to use it as I created my story. So I think different readers will get very different kinds of pleasures out of it. And that's certainly my hope. And it's also my hope that having read the Palace of Illusions, people who haven't read the Mahabharata before will say, okay, let's go back to the source and see. Let's compare the two texts.
And this your version is about a tenth the length of most traditional ones.
That's true.
I found it much easier to get through, though, than I've had William Buck's retelling for a number of years, and I dip into it every now and then. But there are you've left out more characters than he has, and you have interconnected the characters better than he does. In your case, nobody appears unless something is going to happen, whereas in his version, as I guess in the original, there are many little stories that are just thrown in, happen, and then you move on to the next one.
Right, and that is, you know, that is the original kind of epic telling where stories circle in among themselves and many quote-unquote random characters do occur, although ultimately I think every random character is connected to a larger worldview and understanding of how the world functions. But in my my book, in Palace of Illusions, I was very clear right from the beginning. This is Panchali's story. It begins with her birth, it ends with her death, and everyone who comes into this story is connected in some critical way to her life.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking right now with Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni about her new book, The Palace of Illusions. She'll be in California, Northern California, in the next couple of days, in San Francisco, in Menlo Park at Kepler's Books tomorrow, March 4th at 7:30 p.m., and then the next day, Wednesday, she'll be at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco at 12:30 and at the India Community Center at 7 p.m.
Actually, tomorrow, a day after tomorrow, I'll be at the Sunnyvale Library.
So these others are not true?
Yes, the others are true. But
also Sunnyvale.
I'm going to be at Kepler's. I'm going to be at the Mechanics Institute Library. And instead of the community center, we've moved it to the Sunnyvale Library.
Oh, okay. I've got that down.
Thursday evening. Thursday evening at 7.
Okay. Talking about Panchali, the character, everything in the book really mirrors her conflicts, and she is not an entirely admirable person. She's shown as beautiful, brave, very self-confident in many ways, very intelligent, but with a strong desire for vengeance, a strong desire for her own self-aggrandizement and for people to admire her, and a total inability to follow people's advice. Yeah. Not everybody's advice. She does pretty well following most of Krishna's advice, but nobody else's.
Right, right. Yes, and you know, that is her character to a great extent. Her character, even in the original, has the possibilities for all of these conflicts. And I wanted to show Panchali as a very human, at once heroic and human. That's what I wanted to show her as.
I'm trying to think that this could be, to get a Western equivalent, as if maybe Helen of Troy had maybe some emotional connection with Achilles or Ajax or one of the Greek besiegers of Troy.
Right, right. And she, yes, except I think Draupadi or Panchali makes a lot more decisions. She has, except, you know, Helen, I think, and this is just my kind of interpretation, Helen doesn't think as clearly through what she does. She does one thing and then everything is out of her hands. But Panchali is always making decisions, and each of her decisions is going to affect the outcome, the ultimate outcome of the two clans and the Great War.
Now, some of what goes on among all the characters is dependent on their individual decisions, and this fits in with the idea of karma, that either decisions people make in previous lives or in these current life affects what is going to happen to them later on. But there's also an overarching sense of fate. Everyone seems to know that this is going to be the end of one of the ages of Earth, or many of the outcomes will happen no matter what anyone does.
Right, right. And one of the things that really fascinated me when I was reading the Mahabharata is that the writer of the Mahabharata, Vyas, who is also a character, an important character in the Mahabharata, has already written about what's going to happen. So it's like he knows exactly what's going to happen, but he doesn't tell anyone because of this same paradox that you're talking about, because people have to make their decision. He doesn't tell everything about what's going to happen. He'll just give you little inklings, little nuggets of what might happen, because he thinks that that might help you make the right decision or the more virtuous decision. But he won't tell you, but he knows already what's going to happen. So that's the great paradox, which I think both Eastern and to some extent Western literature has struggled with, free will versus destiny. And that's something that Panchali struggles with. She's like, if everything's written already, then what does it matter what I do? And yet she knows that what she does or what decisions she makes will matter ultimately.
You say that you follow the story as given from her birth to her death. The version of the Mahabharata that I was looking at yesterday ends with the destruction of Krishna's kingdom and city. In Palace of Illusions, you go on to Panchali and her five husbands leaving their kingdom, their restored kingdom, and going up into the Himalayas to see if they can reach the land of the gods, knowing that probably only one of them will. I did not find that in the version of the Mahabharata that I read. Is that part of the original, or did you add
that? That is part of the original. That part is definitely there. And in fact, that to me is one of the most poignant parts. And we see this in some epics, some other epics. What happens to the hero when the heroic task is done and the hero is no longer needed, as it were, at least not needed in Earth, not on Earth in the same way as they were needed before. And so now they need to move into another dimension. And so the Pandavas, who were great warriors, find with Krishna's death that their powers have passed away, and they have to decide for themselves who they are then and what they must do. And so to me that is a really powerful part of the epic.
And I found it the most moving part of the novel.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. Now, all of the physical things that happen in that last part is true and based on the original version of the Mahabharata. In fact, all three versions mention this part. But what Panchali goes through as she's on that final journey, that last journey up into the peaks of the Himalayas, that is my invention. What she's thinking about, how she's feeling, what her last thoughts and visions are. That's the part that I put in.
You say you sort of thought when you were a child, if I ever told a story, this is the way I would tell it. Do you have other Indian myths that you wanted to tell when you were young?
Well, one of the things that I'm really very interested in is folk tales. And Bengal, where I grew up, has the most wonderful, amazing folk tales. And actually, many parts of India have their own folk tales. So this is one of my next projects, is to retell a number of these folk tales, many of which are oral tales. So there are no books about these. But I want to kind of go back and remember some of them and talk to older people and collect these and then make them available to children in this country. And I've already written the first one. And I'll share that title with you. Nobody else knows about it yet. So this is for you and our listeners. It's called Grandma and the Giant Gourd.
Uh-huh.
Does that sound interesting?
It sounds interesting.
So that's one of my future projects.
The children's books you've written, I haven't looked at, but they are based more on Indian mythology than your adult fiction up to now. Is that true?
The children's books are also, they are very steeped in mythology. They are modern tales, but again, just like in Sister of My Heart and Mistress of Spices, I've woven in a lot of mythology and folktale beliefs into them. But they are modern tales, as in, they're set in modern times. My book, The Conch Bearer, is set in a modern time, but then it also incorporates elements of fantasy and adventure. Much of it happens up in the Himalayas. Again, I think I'm just fascinated by the Himalayas. There's so many stories about them. But it is about The Conjurer is about a boy and a girl who grow up in the slums of Kolkata, the city where I was born.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni about her latest novel, The Palace of Illusions. And she's going to be in Northern California in the next couple of days. And let's see if I can get this straight. Tomorrow at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. That's tomorrow, Tuesday the 4th at 7:30 p.m. The following day, Wednesday, the Mechanics Institute Library at 12:30 p.m. And then is it that evening, Wednesday evening, or Thursday?
Yes.
Wednesday evening, you'll be at the Sunnyvale Library in Sunnyvale at 7 p.m. Well, thanks so much for being with us, and I hope some of our listeners can make it to your presentations.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Three times over the past 2 years, I've talked with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam about a book he's been working on. The idea was to catch him when he first started writing the book and check in with him every now and then to see how it was progressing. The book is about the Great Books Movement that started around Columbia University in the 20s, gradually shifted its weight over to University of Chicago and to St. John's College, and was something of a big commercial success in the 1950s, then suffered various vicissitudes. Alex Beam is on the line with me again, and we're going to see. I guess, Alex, you're pretty close to finishing the book now?
Yes, Eric. Hi.
Hi.
Modern technology, I'm going to email the chapters to my editor in about 8 or 9 days. It's going to be a relatively short, sort of compact book, about 200 pages. I think it's in its final form, so to speak, so I can sort of answer almost any question about it.
Well, you have a title now. That's the first thing, I guess.
Yeah, it was funny. William Safire years ago made fun of modern nonfiction titles because they're always like title colon and then a kind of oddly descriptive subtitle that's expected to explain to the reader what the book's really about. So the title of this book has always been a great idea at the time, intended to pick up obviously the notion of the great books and also the notion that it's not an idea that's particularly vibrant today. We could bat that notion around if you want, but it certainly isn't as vibrant as it was, say, when they sold a million sets in the 50s and 60s. And I guess the subtitle is something to the effect the rise, fall, and curious afterlife of the great books. Because the last third of my book is about what the Great Books Foundation does today in America, and you know what St. John's does today, how they teach the boys and girls there, which is exactly the way they taught them in 1936, and what Columbia and Chicago do in very, very sort of different objective conditions. You know, they're huge, huge universities, but Columbia specifically, still shoves one full year of a great books education down there, undergraduates craw, which is extremely rare in America.
When I talked to you an hour or so ago, I mentioned that you had been pretty critical of the whole program up to now, but you said you'd grown more forgiving.
I did say that. It's funny. I've always had a sort of an opera bouffe attitude, certainly towards Mortimer Adler, who is in a sense, the certainly a key progenitor of the commercial great books effort at the University of Chicago.
And I think I'm going to cut in right now, and I realize that many of our listeners may have heard the earlier programs, but maybe you could give us like a 3-minute version of the main players and what happened between the mid-20s and the early 50s.
Sure. Sure. The deal was that, yes, there was a kind of genteel professor at Columbia, this has a very complicated ideological context, meaning the rise of the research university modeled on the great German universities at the beginning of the 20th century in America. And some guy from a good family at Columbia said, you know, we should have our undergraduates read the Iliad and not in Greek. So he had this notion of teaching a great books course to undergraduates at Columbia where they would read the great works of literature in translation and without studying the history, the linguistics, without all the sort of surrounding baggage. And this really became the great books movement. Mortimer Adler, a very young Columbia professor, took this idea to the University of Chicago because he literally entranced the equally young and brilliant Robert Hutchins, who had been dean of the Yale Law School, was kind of seduced into taking the presidency of the University of Chicago, which again, to be painfully blunt, was probably a greater university in the 30s, 40s, and 50s than it is now. I know that, again, something that we could quibble over. But it's a dramatic story. A 29-year-old takes over really one of the great research universities in the country and starts saying, I want the undergraduates to study the great books. And to skip forward a bit, a third man walks into the play, a man named William Benton, who has actually purchased, of all things, the Encyclopedia Britannica from Sears Roebuck, which had no business ever owning it. And he also works at the University of Chicago. And he wants to make some money. So he says, how can we make some money? Britannica is sort of a break-even proposition. And the three of them say, well, let's get some academics together in a room. Let's choose what we call the great books of the Western world, and then let's sell them. Let's sell them to middle-class Americans. And starting in 1952, they did just that. And they sold them for a moderate price, in the hundreds of dollars. Obviously, the price has changed over the years, but for about $400 or $500. They sold 54 volumes of the great books of the Western world. No real surprises. Obviously, we don't want to go through all 70 authors, but no women, no people of color, all dead white men. I mean, I guess I'd make this little joke about St. Augustine because I'm not sure his ethnicity is 1,000%. But in any case, that's really the story I'm telling, with one coda, which is that this guy Mortimer Adler lived to an incredibly old age of 98, and he tried to relaunch the great books of the Western world on behalf of Britannica in 1990. And it was just the times were all wrong, it was a complete failure. So that's so when I talk about the afterlife of the great books, I talk about the extremely anemic kind of great books movement that the Great Books Foundation, which was created by Hutchins and Adler, does still exist. And my local library and frankly your local library, many local libraries in America, have monthly meetings of great books discussion groups, which I've been attending and generally enjoying. And they also have Great Books Weekends, where you can pay a few hundred dollars and have a sort of directed study of three books, etc., etc. And then you have the afterlife in the academy, which I guess I went over just before, at the universities that I had talked about before, Columbia, Chicago, and St. John's.
We said that you had been pretty critical. You were particularly critical of Adler, a little less so of, I'd say much less so of Hutchins, and maybe equally so of Benton. But how do you feel now?
Well, I mean, Hutchins is sort of a magnificent figure. There's many biographies of him. I haven't really altered my attitude towards Mortimer Adler at all, and that's really because I bought so many copies of a Firing Line, and I've seen so much of him on television. He's just a kind of an annoying personality. I think I think he would be an important person in American popular culture, and I really regret saying this, but if he had died maybe at age 65 or 70, he just sort of lived on as he started saying very, very stupid things, and they're all in my book. There's no need to go over those. I think he became a clown, you know, and the problem with people when they become old is they become resentful. And he became just plain, you know, angry and resentful. I've been reading Harold Bloom, of all things, just lately, whom I remember lecturing at Yale, and it's a kind of a wonderful, vivid intelligence. But, you know, he's extremely accomplished, but he's become sort of a railer. You know, he rails against modern times. And Adler was that.
And he doesn't have an editor. That's the main thing I'd say about Bloom. He has... any one of his rants might have two or three brilliant insights in it, but there's no balance and no editing.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, and I certainly agree as to the brilliant insights, and I think he's really a brilliant writer as well. But a bit of a poser, and certainly maybe a little bit different from Adler. Having written the conclusion, you know, I guess the conclusion of my book says a few things. I mean, first of all, I suppose I can be accused of being woolly-headed, but I mean, you know, I state a few extremely obvious points. One of them, you know, that like, you know, Oprah's book club, which everyone likes to malign, is really, if you look at what the Great Books Foundation was doing in 1947, there's really hardly any difference between Oprah getting 1 million people to buy Anna Karenina and, again, what the Great Books Foundation was doing with relatively highbrow novels. There are many small colleges that still teach the Great Books. There's sort of a pressure group for core curricula in American colleges. I think they would say that that core curricula are on an upswing. And I don't see any real evidence of that, but I know that's certainly one of their come-ons. I mean, the great books I think are actually in slightly, you know, a better shape. It's curious that whole kind of mid-80s attack on the canon has really receded. It really is a little bit like a tide. Someone sort of forced me to read a book by Anthony Cronman. Let me get it in my hand because it has a rather elaborate title. It's called Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life. It's a wild title, but what it actually is, it's a stirring defense of the great books by a former dean of the Yale Law School, which is what Hutchins himself was, who now teaches in Yale has a very tiny Great Books program. It's had one since 1947, which is sort of precisely when the movement I'm writing about began. And this guy Cronman left the law school to teach the Great Books at Yale. And I guess the last line of my book, and it's subject to change, is, you know, the Great Books are dead, long live the Great Books. It's pretty clear that, you know, no serious intellectual endeavor in our language, in my opinion, you know, is ever going to move forward without touching base with, the roots or the heritage of the Western tradition. I should say as a parenthesis that this guy Cronman goes much further than that. And Cronman makes the point, which is interesting, and I hadn't thought of it this way, that... that what we now casually call globalization, he calls a worldwide embrace of Western values. And actually, you and I basically attended college around the same time. I would say we're exposed to a kind of a very different worldview that for whatever reason was encouraging, you know, a much more open and relativistic view of sort of competing ways of seeing the world.
Yeah, I think we're much... Globalization has, up to now, been McDonald's, Disney, Hollywood, and all the underlying oil and other huge businesses. But it's beginning to work in the opposite direction, and we're getting more and more influences from India, China, Japan, the Middle East, and so on. But that's aside from the main point. You said you were almost finished, but you said you've written the conclusion. So what are you writing in between?
I have finished. I mean, I guess just today I was working on the conclusion, so it seemed like that would be something to talk about. I'm really just sort of plugging in holes at this point. I interviewed the woman who runs the Yale Directed Studies program today. Notre Dame, again, as long as Yale, ever since Adler was a great fake Catholic, if you don't mind my saying so, and he was always friends with the presidents of Notre Dame because they were great universities, frankly, in the same neighborhood. And also he was fascinated by Thomas Aquinas. And Notre Dame has had an undergraduate great books program called the Program for Liberal Studies. So actually, to me, that's just like some, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. I've been making some calls on that. I'm hoping to interview this evening a Hollywood actress who was a great books discussion group leader in the 1950s.
Can you drop any names?
I don't want to spoil the karma. I'm very hopeful that it's going to turn out right. But anyway, I can't drop her. I apologize. Not right now.
That's fine. We'll have to wait till November, which I guess is the planned publication date.
Yes, I guess since I talked to you, I went to the Modern Language Association meeting in Chicago, and where there was a definitely very chilly reception for the great books from the modern academicians.
You went around asking them what they thought?
No, not really, but I gave a talk in front of several hundred of them, and I don't know, you know, that it's never been, I sort of exaggerate because some questioners were very, at least wanted to talk a great deal about their own experiences with the great books, but the upshot was, I think, some people invited me to the Chicago Humanities Festival, which takes place in the fall. It's really odd, as a parenthesis. I knew you grew up in Chicago, and I think we've talked about this before, but it's genuinely odd how this spirit literally lives on in Chicago. Anyway, so that's when I think we're going to basically publish the book in the hopes that we can sell a few copies at the Chicago Humanities Festival, and then obviously we'll sell copies everywhere else as well.
How is it living on more in Chicago? Because you mentioned, I did not know about the Notre Dame program or the Yale one. So there's obviously, it's more than just St. John's. But what are the remaining outposts in Chicago?
Well, I mean, the University of Chicago itself makes much of its core curriculum, I mean, which they admit they require all undergraduates to take. I mean, it is not a great books core curriculum, far, far from it. It's not like the Columbia core curriculum, which is a great books core curriculum. But I guess, oddly, I mean, first of all, I consider the Oprah thing, you know, a kind of a very Adler-esque.
And also out of Chicago.
Also out of Chicago, just a couple miles from Adler's old office. And As I write in my book, curiously, the University of Chicago has, of all things, has an extension school called the Graham Extension School, and they actually teach virtually the same Hutchins curriculum from, say, 1948 to adults. It's a kind of a fee-based extension school, and I interviewed that lady, and she's in my book to a certain extent. So, you know, there's... That's a very odd. You'll recognize this reference. She's a product of the Committee on Social Thought, and which I guess I call it the Shadowy Committee on Social Thought, but is a relatively, I also call it a high-toned intellectual parking lot. But as you know, Bellow hung out there. It was sort of a place that I think Hutchins created at Chicago for people to do interdisciplinary work. Leo Strauss was there, Alan Bloom was there, many great intellectuals were there, but it's always also been and by the way, a lot of St. John's graduates, curiously, end up there as PhD candidates. But anyway, I mean, so it's always been sort of conservative, and she's sort of conservative. And in my book, she's actually very critical of what the university did, meaning the University of Chicago did with its core curriculum, meaning they sort of turned it into something kind of watery, and, you know, you can study whatever you want. Just as a tiny footnote, I am quite aware, I don't know how many of your listeners care, but I am quite aware that there's the Thomas Aquinas College in California and also Santa Rosa College, I think is the correct name.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two small Catholic, all great books, institutions. But, I mean, I haven't bothered to visit them the way I bothered to visit St. John's. I mean, I had to make a bunch of choices. I felt this could not be a long book. I just felt people couldn't read a long book about the great books. And to me, I mean, St. John's is an important part of American intellectual history. The two small colleges I just mentioned, you know, have been in existence only about 30 years, if that. You know, St. John's has been in existence, well over 70 years. So I made my choices, and I'm sort of sticking with them.
So what remains in the publishing process? Part of the time we've been talking in these last 2 years about the actual content of the book, but a lot about how you've gone about writing it. What remains to be done?
Well, I'm going to send the manuscript to the editor, a woman named Lisa Kaufman. Typically, she will read it. It won't take her very long. She'll get back to me with comments. And, you know, I will have a few weeks to revise the manuscript. You know, probably talk to her. We've worked together before on a nonfiction book I published in 2001 called Gracefully Insane. So I think, knock on wood, we'll work together. Okay, this time I need to go down. I mean, it's odd how quickly this all happens, but I want to do some lobbying for some illustrations. So the order of operations is once we have a manuscript, meaning after editing and revisions, I'll go down there and see if I can I'd love to get some fun illustrations kind of woven into the text. That's always weird in modern it's not that weird, but the publisher, you know, charges you to do that, so you always have to. It's kind of a delicate negotiation where you hope they'll get excited and bear some of the costs, et cetera, et cetera.
So you want photographs, line drawings?
Well, there's New Yorker cartoons about the great books. I have a picture of this Hollywood starlet in a bathing suit. He used to be a great books discussion group leader. There's tremendous pictures. Life magazine was almost a sort of a propaganda arm for the great books. And there's some terrific pictures about the various indexing schemes they had. And we do want pictures of Hutchins and Adler. St. John's, their famous croquet matches against the U.S. Naval Academy. I don't see how I could not have a picture of that. Robert Hutchins' wife had a famous nude Christmas card that depicted her daughter. I might toss that in, although it seems almost totally irrelevant to what I'm writing about. But, I don't know. I would love to. I would love for it not to be just a text product.
You said you're sending the manuscript to your editor. Has she seen any of it up to now?
No, not really. I guess 2 years ago or 18 months ago, she saw the proposal. It's about 18 months ago. It's really weird. She had to write a description of the book for the catalog, which I still haven't seen. I've seen the description. And she asked me to send her the introduction, which she absolutely hated. So I quickly rewrote the introduction. No, she hasn't seen any of it. But it cleaves very closely to what I said it would be in the proposal. I seem to have had the basic outlines of not so much. you know, what my conclusions would be, but certainly what I wanted to cover in the book. So I don't know. I'm feeling relatively calm. I don't think she'll be surprised in a bad way, and I hope she'll be surprised in a good way.
But she's confident enough to write the copy for the catalog.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
Now, as I've been telling our listeners, and I'll repeat to them, that this is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City, and that I am Eric Tome, and that I am talking with Alex Beam, author, now it is called A Good Idea at the Time.
A Great Idea.
A Great Idea at the Time, which is a history of the... Give me the subtitle.
It's The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books of the Western World.
Well, we've been talking about this for the past 2 years, and I imagine we will talk about it again in November. I could either talk to... Well, actually, I'd like to... Before I talk to you again, I'd like to actually read the book. And probably be best if we talk about it after it comes out. It's going to be timed with this Humanities Festival in Chicago?
Yes, I think... I can get you a galley, God willing, you know, hopefully in the early fall.
Well, I want to see the pictures, and the galleys usually don't have the pictures.
I can get you a copy, but that'll be that'll be later. I'm sort of a great believer in attending to what it is I am supposed to attend to. So I'm not totally on top of the publication schedule. I know the Humanities Festival hasn't even been firmly scheduled. So I just need to make my next hit my next mark, which is 10 days from now. I need to send in the manuscript.
Great. Well, thanks, Alex. Send me a copy when it's ready, and we'll talk again around November.
Well, thank you, Eric, and thanks again for your interest.
Okay. Bye.
Take care.
This has been Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party.